This is Marine Interviewer Staff Sergeant John T. McDaniel, stationed at Marine Corps Base Headquarters, Building 1160, G3, Room 224, Camp Pendleton, California. Today for interview we have Marine First Lieutenant David O. Carter, service number 010-3397. Assigned as Platoon Commander, H&S Company, 3rd Battalion, 28th Marines, 5th Marine Division, Camp Pendleton, California. Lieutenant Carter was in Vietnam from December the 25th, 1967 to April the 17th,
1968,
and was Platoon Commander, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, 3rd Marine Division. Lieutenant Carter, tell us about your experiences while you were in Vietnam.
When I first arrived in Vietnam, I was assigned to 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, Charlie Company. My basic job was that of a platoon commander, taking over a platoon of approximately 72 men. The mission of our unit basically was search and destroy. We began at Camp Evans when I joined them and moved into the city of Way to guard bridges into an outpost of PK-17 and into Hill 51 in the Covey-Tonton Valley. My first month of combat experience was more in the form of security for CBs, small night patrols, ambushes, nothing much over platoon size. At this time, it was just before the Tet Offensive, we did notice many troops moving down through the Covey-Tonton Valley, and they were moving in twos, threes, and fours. It was hard to ambush them, but some of our patrols took the form of going out two, three nights and sitting in the rain waiting for them. We did manage to kill 17 my second week there on a fairly small unit action. One thing we did notice, nobody before the Tet Offensive seemed to know where these troops were going. It was hard to get at them because of their small movements. Because of this, we feel that possibly these troops were the troops used in the Battle of Way and that they moved right through the Covey-Tonton Valley. This is some of the conclusions reached by some of the younger lieutenants that were out in this valley at the time. After the Tet Offensive did break out, we realized what had happened. After Way, we were in Way until January 21st, which was about 9 days before the Tet Offensive. Caisson broke out at that time, and we were put on helicopters out of Camp Evans, where the Army relieved us and moved right into Caisson the first day of the big rocket attack. We landed at Caisson, moved into defensive positions just outside the main airstrip, and began to dug in. Within an hour after that, we received 500 mortar rocket and artillery rounds. And from that point on, for the next 3.5 months, I was involved in the siege of Caisson as a platoon commander and as an XO of a company. During this time, our main job was just that of a static defensive position. We were not allowed to patrol out past 600 meters because one company in 126 had moved out approximately 1,000 meters and had been ambushed with 27 missing in actions and close to 20 killed. A whole battalion had moved in behind them at that time, and they inflicted pretty serious casualties on these people. Caisson was nothing more than classic siege tactics. Apparently General Jopp, the North Vietnamese commander, made a mistake by committing his artillery before he committed his troops. He had numerous artillery pieces, some estimate between 40 and 50 dug into the size of hills, but didn't have his troops ready to go on the 21st of January. And because of this, he could never amass and never really hit us as hard as he wanted to. And it's history now that the arc lights and the close air support that we got at Caisson was excellent. If nothing else, I think that this was a classic action where the Marine Corps was involved in something it might not have been prepared for. We didn't have the equipment at Caisson. Caisson had been poorly prepared for this siege. When we arrived there, things were above ground. On Okinawa, I received an S2 briefing, and I'll say it just like it is, that there were approximately 6 regiments operating in and around Caisson. And it calls to my mind why Caisson was not dug in, why there were not fortifications, trenches, bunkers already set up at that time. This was done after the rocket attack, it seemed to me, and should have been done long before. The North Vietnamese around us were estimated at 30,000 troops approximately, with numerous backup units. And as history recalls now, we were completely cut off from the outside world. We received mail 3 times when I was at Caisson. We did get excellent supply. The shore party up there probably did the most outstanding job I've ever seen any unit do in the Marine Corps. The morale at Khe Sanh is probably the highest I've seen at any time inside the Marine Corps, and if there's something I will ever recall about the Marine Corps, it will be this one particular instance of Khe Sanh. The troopers, individual troopers, performed outstandingly well there. I think this was, number one, and due to the aggressive leadership of the young officers involved at Khe Sanh, and we did have some excellent field commanders in the field. There was dissension at no time. If anything, is a classic conduct of Marine Corps officers and men in a combat situation. We really got down to it. There were 5,000 people cut off, and everybody knew this. When we received mail, we burned our letters at night because we were told we would be overrun, and everybody felt the urgency of this, especially when Long Bay was hit and the Gooks used 15 tanks and wiped out that Special Forces camp. Basically, we patrolled, as I said, no less than 500 to 700 meters outside of Khe Sanh. Yet we knew the North Vietnamese were around us because at nights they probe our lines. A sapper squad moved inside our lines the first night there. We hadn't had a chance to dig in. Elephant grass was still up, and they got two or three people inside some of our fighting holes. All throughout the siege, we improved upon our positions for 3.5 months. We built trenches approximately 8 feet down with step-ups, and another 4 feet down below the ground after that. Also, the equipment kept rolling in. We received 106s after a while, more machine guns, and constantly improved our positions. During this time, the support we did get as far as logistics was outstanding. The limited number of things we had to begin with right at the beginning of the siege, you could count on your hands. We didn't have any alum for mortars for a while. We had very few 60 mic rounds for the mortars. Machine gun ammo was limited. Cleaning gear was almost non-existent. We made do with what we had, and overall it was an outstanding job. During this time, we had artillery supporting us at Khe Sanh that did a tremendous job, as well as the air, which is already a foregone conclusion. Artillery people stuck by their guns and fired right back at the North Vietnamese during incoming rounds, even on days when we were receiving between 1,300 and 1,500 rounds a day up there, which happened twice to my recollection. On any patrol that we conducted outside of Khe Sanh, we moved out usually with one platoon. In 1-9 we did, basically because you couldn't move a company out 500 meters. They were too bunched and you were all subject to artillery. Hopefully you could get off just before morning and be out and set up in a somewhat small assembly area before daylight broke. Not too far out, maybe just 300-400 meters, and this way they wouldn't spot you going out with artillery and rocket ship. Basically, I feel that this was just to keep them a little ways away from our lines. They did have trenches very in close proximity. You could see them building the trenches, you could see them digging, and the only way we could root them out wasn't with artillery, it was with napalm and jets coming in. We had air constantly on station. I understand they had holding patterns up there. There was so much air, and I can't speak highly enough for the close support we got from the B-52s, which was pinpoint, and the Marine Navy fighters who came in within 100 meters of our lines at times to strafe rocket and drop napalm. They moved the North Vietnamese back, and subsequently saved quite a few lives up there. Basically, patrolling out in platoon formation, we used a double column. I didn't see anything used too much more in Vietnam, especially up around the DMZ where it was hilly and wooded. You used a double column with a real strong point. If you had a weak flank or an exposed flank with open terrain, then you'd throw out a flank of at times you could throw out a squad when you had a 70-man platoon as large as I did, but it was always within eye distance so you could see them, and you always tried to put out as much firepower with them as you could. This time all my people carried at least one law, preferably two if they could get it on their back. I felt that this was one of the best fire support weapons you could have, right organic to your platoon, especially with a tank threat up there. We did hear tanks at night, just after Long Bay and a little bit before Long Bay. So we sure know that they were existent. After the siege of Khe Sanh, it broke on April 4th, and Charlie 1-9 and the 1st Battalion 9th Marines were the first battalion to break out of Khe Sanh. Our basic mission was to go south to Route 9, Hill 471, to take Hill 471, and to wait there in a link-up operation with the airborne units and the 101st Air Cav, or the 1st Air Cav that was coming in, along with the 1st Marines clearing Route 9. We knew that North Vietnamese were still strong, their positions out there. The hill had been arc lighted. I was in a unique position as I was the point platoon in the Point Battalion moving out from Quezon. So we were the first ones out. We came out at 3 o'clock in the morning. I understand General Kulak was up there and a few other people. And we moved, set up on a company objective one, which was about 500 meters short of Hill 471 in the early morning. We were there by 3 o'clock and we moved out. We received no contact that day until approximately 4 o'clock in the afternoon when we started to take Hill 471. And although not involved in the original assault, we could see it real well, and we got mortared, rocketed as everybody else, and finally went up to ourselves and suffered some casualties. What happened here, basically, the North Vietnamese came up from Route 9, racing us to the top of this hill because it was strategic terrain, and we came up from the other side, from Quezon side, and met at the top. They killed about 110 that day of the North Vietnamese. Excuse me. 1-9 suffered about 10 KIA and about 20 WIAs. That night, my platoon perimeter and the platoon right next to me and Charlie Company, we were hit by 1st and 2nd and 3rd Battalions of the 66th Marine Regiment, North Vietnamese. They made a classic mistake. They came at us, 200 of them up a gully in column, and as such we stacked up 175 to 180 on the hillside alone with small arms. We caught another 200 out in the rice paddies with time on targets and 175s from Camp Carroll. Lost one man that night and one wounded, which is outstanding. I think it goes to show what a good defensive position could do. We worked real hard on our defensive positions the short time we had. I can't say enough for flak jackets, helmets, and digging in immediately. It was already a foregone conclusion. Next day we went down to clear the landing zone and the hills around us and took 5 prisoners. We were told prisoners were needed, so we made every effort we could. Even at one point when it was doubtful in my mind we should have taken a prisoner, one of my men was seriously exposed, but we took him. One of them was 13 years old, apparently. Their weapons were excellent. They had Swedish medical gear, AK-47s, Russian sniper rifles, and RPG-4s, which we captured and fired into Quezonville at them. We thought it was kind of funny firing their weapons at them when they were running away. They were still in Quezonville. We don't know how many were down there, but I know that night we destroyed the 66th Regiment. They were taken out as an effective fighting force for quite a while. At this time, the M16 rifle held up very well. I'll have a lot more to say about this later on. But at this time, we had had cleaning gear in Quezon, or enough and time enough in defensive positions to clean it. We had a standard policy in my platoon and in the company as a whole that before you did anything in the morning, you cleaned your weapon, period. That was it. First thing you do when you get up. As the operation went on and time got shorter, you still clean your weapons, but once the gear started running out and got worn, the M16 didn't turn out to be quite the weapon it really could have been used for. After Hill 471, we swung north, and 1-9 was the only battalion operating outside of Quezon at this time. The 26th Marine Regiment was still inside the perimeter, and they were using 1-9 out there as the first battalion to move out and strike at the North Vietnamese. We moved to Hill 552, which is west towards Laos. You can see it from Quezon from the western side. It's a predominant ridge, and it runs 552, 689, and 789. It's the next ridge line over from Hill 881 north and south. The North Vietnamese were running this way, and it was hoped that we'd get them trapped. As the Army moved in their fire support units on top of hills, they moved into Long Bay, and we started to swing north, hoping to cut them off and get them in the box. We moved up Hill 552. My platoon was the first one up. We didn't receive any fire from the North Vietnamese. They'd run off the ridges. We had an excellent 3 at the time, a man who'd taken over the 3 shop and was only a captain, a man named Captain Hartzell, who I understand was subsequently put on a report for later action, which we'll get to in a while. His tactics were he'd move out 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We'd be set up at the base of the hill and ready to attack. Just as first daylight broke, he'd get in close air support for us, get some artillery in there, and we'd go up it. And time and time again, I felt we moved the North Vietnamese off these ridges by moving it very aggressively at night. We got so we could operate at night. We had confidence in ourselves, and I think we stole a little bit of thunder from the North Vietnamese this way. We saved a lot of men, and it was really a surprise tactics because I think most Marine Corps units feel secure and don't realize that the night over there can be their best friend. We had a lot of gear with us, and this is something that does limit you in an operation, I feel, especially the hill humping we were doing and trying to get up there during the daylight. But we didn't have as much as most tactical units carry. We had such good logistics that
we weren't carrying all the goodies we needed on our backs. We had the ammo that we needed and the basic essentials, and that was it, nothing extra. We, everybody carried a poncho liner, and everything else was left behind. We moved up to 5.52, and until April 16th, we kept moving along that ridge line. We found numerous anti-aircraft rifles, we found a 37 brand new. It had never been used. It had just been set up, in fact, I'm sure, but they hadn't even had time to clean the thing, unless they came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail with it. They had ammo, numerous bunkers were dug along the tops of the hills, and this may interest whoever reads this or hears this tape. We always thought that the North Vietnamese would never dig bunkers on the top of a hill, that they'd be on the side of the hill and defilade or down in the ridges and saddles. Not so. At Khe Sanh, they put their bunkers directly on top of the hill on the ridge lines we were at and dug them flat with the ground. In other words, they dug a hole down 4 or 5 feet and then dug in, covered it over with brush. So they sat right on the top of the ridge lines and could look right down at you. We discovered an FO post up there, complete with comm wire. It was a beautiful setup that could spot Khe Sanh, and you could sit there and pick out anybody moving around down there. They had a 50 caliber that could have sniped at you from up there. We continued to move along that ridge until we took 689. My platoon the entire time walked point, and we were the first ones up, partly because we had one of the best trained platoons in the battalion up there, and we were real aggressive. Most of the people wanted to. We took 689 and began to dug in. A squad of NVA moved up on a far ridge line. We estimated a squad with mortars, and within 10 minutes after our taking 689, they'd opened up with mortars on us. And we called in air and drove them away, but they gave us 20 KIA right in that period of time. What had happened was they hit us with small arms fires and we moved off the ridge. We consolidated, started dug in, but their plan all the time had been to get us up there on that ridge, along the side of it, and they had that ridge already pre-plotted with 82s, which means they didn't have to expend any of their own men in this thing. We stayed there one night, second night, and thought we'd be hit for sure. They were out there, still pretty strong evidently, but nobody knew where. The Arvins and the Army had swept through the ridge line west of us the day before, and we thought that they'd destroyed any bunkers out there, but Alpha Company 19 went out the next day, next ridge line over towards Lals, about 2 clicks away, and they got ambushed. They suffered 30 KIA or so within a very short time. The company was completely pinned down. What the North Vietnamese had done, they'd been so well camouflaged that Alpha Company apparently had walked right in between the spider holes and had not seen the enemy, so you had your own dead and wounded Marines laying in between the spider holes out there. You couldn't call in air, you couldn't call in artillery, so on this particular day, the day I was hit, Delta Company swung around to the right, Charlie Company swung around to the left. Delta Company came across the ridge line, was pinned down by 82 mortar fire that had that pre-plotted, and the only choice for Charlie Company was to get on lines and line in classic Marine fashion with bayonets and whatever we had and come up the hill out of them. It was right out of the Stone Ages, but it was the one thing that we were prepared for, and we're adequately prepared for. We wanted them pretty badly. We got up to the top of the hill, and they were everywhere. They were dug in bunkers. Myself, I was hit 3 times. I went up with 32 men, and only 8 men didn't get hit. We did one hell of a job up there. I think the only thing that saved us was basic aggressiveness at this time. If we would have followed on the side of the hill, they had that hill fire swept, there would have been one man that walked out of it. Most of the stuff was close. I never did see national hand-to-hand encounter, although many of my kids went in the bunkers after these North Vietnamese, and I know they killed them with their hands or with 45s in there. I was hit 3 times that day, and subsequently, 8 or 9 hours after the action began, medevac back to the United States, or back to Guam, to Da Nang, then to Guam. I do have something to say about the M16 rifle at this time, getting back to this. This is I noticed 3 rifles up there that jammed, and this is interesting for one reason. I know darn well that these weapons were as clean as could be kept for this given amount of time. Maybe an excuse can be made, or maybe some doubtful person will say, well, this lieutenant or lieutenants over there or young staff sergeants, etc., don't have their weapons clean. If you're in combat for 3.5 to 4 months straight as we were, you have your weapons clean. You know that is about the only thing that does count. Those weapons were clean. to the best of our ability at that time. What we didn't have was the proper cleaning gear. And this goes along with my contention that the M16 is probably the finest weapon in the world today, if you have the equipment and if you have the time and a table to keep it clean. But when you get out in the bush, it seems to me to be too sophisticated a weapon and not durable enough. By this I mean the locking recesses on this are hard as hell to clean. You can't get at them unless you've got a specially made brush, possibly a toothbrush, which half the people over there don't even have after a while. And if you don't have this cleaning gear, you're in quite a bit of trouble with it. Three of these weapons did jam. I think that in comparison, the AK-47 for the type of fighting we were doing was a much better weapon. It was much more durable. Maybe it wasn't as light, maybe it didn't give out as much cyclical fire, but you still had that weapon functioning. The Stoner system, I understand that the SEALs tested down on the Mekong Delta is excellent. I think the M16 rifle would be excellent in 99% of the combat situations used over there. It just did not, I feel, work out in our particular case. All the resupply we got was through the Marine sources, Marine helicopters, except for some medevacs. We had the Army warrant officers that came in and got our medevacs, a lot of them. They did an outstanding job, both Marines and warrant officers did. A couple times Marines weren't able to get in, and the warrant officers volunteered to come in. I have the highest respect for these people. The morale during the whole time, one night had been out there so long that I don't think that there were too many people that didn't realize that they were going to get hit this particular day. There wasn't too much doubt in our minds. We knew what was up there basically when we started off, and throughout all this, I think the basic discipline of these young Marines showed up. People that are 18, 19, 20 years old did an outstanding job. There were more instances of heroism and individual aggressive displays out there than I can possibly recount. I don't think any medal at this time would have been adequate for some of the things that these people did, but I understand subsequently many of them didn't receive awards because in the rear it was decided to break these awards down from Silver Stars to Bronze Stars, or Bronze Stars is down to Navy Achievement Medals, which is my pet peeve, especially from somebody back in Da Nang who makes this decision. I think this is a basic platoon commander's decision, and some of the awards I wrote up didn't go through. I'm highly displeased about this. During my 4.5 months at Quezon, our living conditions basically were whatever we could find. When we first got there, we slept in the rain. Nobody saw a cot or a hammock or anything like this, which was just fine with most of us. We dug in to get out of the rain. When it did rain, we dug even deeper and furrowed back like squirrels. We were below the ground during the day 99% of the time. At night, everybody was on 50%. And after a while, as the parachutes started to drop in, we took parachutes to wrap ourselves up and keep warm with at night. This is what we used. 26 Marines were a lot better off. They'd been there and had gear before. We made do with what we could. We received three meals a day most of the time, and the only time we ever ran short of that was we received one meal a day on the operations, which kept us going usually. That was adequate for the short period of time. Water wasn't a problem. Keeping clean was. There were no showers, there were no baths up there to speak of. We had a stream that we secured sometimes and could get down to, but that was very rare. What we needed mostly was socks. You couldn't keep your feet clean. Some socks would just literally rot off your feet. One of the largest problems were infections. If nothing else, you inspected your men. Every man up there that I could get my hands on, we didn't have any clippers. No, we didn't have haircuts. Literally, we cut them with an old pair of rusty clippers we found, and just shaved everything off we could just to keep the hair clean, keep ourselves as clean as we could. Okay, as far as the training went before we went over to Vietnam, I feel in my particular case as a young officer over there that my training was 100% adequate. I understand that my class, basic class 667, was under some type of an investigation. Because we suffered 84% casualties. In other words, 84% of our class were either killed or wounded in Vietnam. And I attribute this personally to the fact that we arrived there just as Tet started. We were young second lieutenants at the time. You either learned or you got hit, and oftentimes it was both. I see no deficit at any point in my training. And I think I was very well prepared for combat. in Vietnam, I was not prepared for the situation I ran into of what is expected, and I'll say this as straight as I can, from units or unit commanders who are not out in the field. Policing a battlefield, number one, during incoming or when expected incoming is about to happen, I think, is asinine. I know of a specific case where a man lost a leg because he was policing a battlefield, not during incoming, but it was imminent. And I don't know whether this was for the Army's point of view, who were going to come in and we wanted to show them we had a clean battlefield, or whether this was along with our doctrine. It might have been wise to keep these battlefields clean and policed up because of possible future booby traps, but I don't think it was warranted at this time. I think that most unit commanders recognize that once you are in the field, the only thing that counts is contacting the enemy and killing them. It's as simple as that. I think the spit and polish leaves, and basically you're there to do a job, and that one job is to find him and destroy him. A lot of the other stuff can stand by the wayside as far as I'm concerned until this is over with. We never did get to a rear area the time I was there, except with the possible exception of what you'd call Camp Evans, if you can call that a rear area. And that was pretty quiet. The rest of the time we were in the field or on operations or humping. And as such, I never saw Dong Ha or Da Nang or any of these places. So my entire time in Vietnam was limited to combat and being on operations. I was never in the rear area there. The North Vietnamese at the time that we took the five prisoners and brought their bodies up and had a chance to examine them were excellently dressed. They had brand new uniforms, good boots, but they were young, very young, 13 years old, as I mentioned before, in the one case of this captive prisoner that we took. The weapons were brand new also. They were excellent quantity and quality. There was no case of sharing a weapon that we could find. The Swedish medical gear that they had was as good or better than ours. They had excellent discipline, I felt, even though they had poor tactics in the time we ran into them. I don't think that they were well trained at all. And I respect them, but I don't think they're a very good fighting unit unless they can catch you in a defensive position with 82s right on top of them. Probably the most interesting thing that came out of my experience as far as tactics go was their willingness to dig a fighting hole, put men in it, and then fire 82 mortars right in on top of their position. In other words, the Marines would be assaulting a hill on line, and you'd have to be standing up, moving up a hill. They'd be on top of the hill, and as you came up to them, real close contact, they'd start calling in 82 mortars right on their own positions. And they might kill a few of their own people, but you were the one exposed above the ground, and you were going to get it far worse. I think that's a very interesting concept that they had. And also their ability to wait with patience until you were right on top of them. It's hard to detect a man over there on a hillside as thick as a train around caisson. We did notice any number of methods that they used to move gear, including the use of elephants over there, which was pretty interesting. They pulled some expedients out that we'd never even thought of. I understand that the bicycle can carry 500 pounds over there, and although we never found bicycles, we had evidence of a tremendous amount of trucks around caisson and coolie work, etc. Some of the deficiencies I noticed in the average Marine's training over there, number one, I'd say mapping. Ability to read a map, it's as simple as that, to find his way around. I don't think he received enough of that. At Quezon, it wasn't as needed as it could have been in other places, but I felt they were deficient in their training, and subsequently we held classes up there on it. As far as individual weapons go, these people knew their weapons backwards and forwards better than some of their instructors probably after they got done up there. The other deficiency, I'd say, basically was in concept of tactics, and I realize that there isn't enough time to teach a young Marine this, and half the time many of these tactics aren't used in Vietnam because the train dictates most of the time to do move in a parallel column up there. But as far as basic tactics, these are easily forgotten. I'm sure that they're taught one time, and something we found was that we constantly refresh them. At night, inside the perimeter, we'd run small patrols up and down our road inside our own perimeter just to refresh them sometimes. We did action drills. We conducted these also and carried out as much ITR-type training in all our spare time as we could. One thing that I noticed from 3 months sitting inside the perimeter caisson was that the need for physical exercise up there. When you're cooped up all day at night, you want to get out and try to run a little bit or exercise. This is one of the hardest things in the world to do. But by the time we started on the operation, we were still pretty physically fit. And all it was a little bit of extra initiative on these people's part, and we were ready to go. That about sums up my experiences in Vietnam. I believe that I saw quite a bit of contact and combat for the time I was there, more so than many people there quite a bit longer. Although I feel like I don't have a good overall view of Vietnam because my only role, as I said, was in and around Hue and at Quezon. So a lot of MedCap and various other type programs conducted there, I didn't have a chance to experience.
Thank you, Lieutenant Carter. This is Marine Engineer Staff Sergeant John T. McDaniel from Marine Corps Base Headquarters, Building 1160, G3, Room 224, Camp Pendleton, California. This interview complies with Marine Corps Order 5750.38.